After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
Welcome to the Real Change series on the Metta Hour with Sharon Salzberg. Inspired by Sharon's newest book, Real Change, this series features conversations with activists, artists, and teachers, all discussing the intersection of meditation and social action. To learn more, visit realchangebook.com.
Hi, I'm Sharon Salzberg, and I'm speaking today with Anu Gupta for the Real Change podcast series. Anu is a scientist, educator, lawyer, and the founder of Be More with Anu. He has logged over 10,000 hours of meditation and developed Be More with Anu's science-backed, compassion-based approach. After conducting decade-long research on the causes of and solutions to racial and gender inequality, having trained over 16,000 people, Anu has spoken about his work on the TED stage, South by Southwest, and the 10% Happier podcast. He's a graduate of the Mindful Yoga and Meditation Teacher Training Program at Spirit Rock and sits on the Barry Center for Buddhist Studies board. Barry Center for Buddhist Studies is right down the road from where I am now. Welcome to the Metta Hour, Anu.
Thanks so much for having me, Sharon.
This recording is part of a larger series of conversations on the Metta Hour centered around the themes of my book, Real Change, Mindfulness to Heal Ourselves and the World. And it reminds me, Anu, that you were a really important part of an earlier book of mine, Real Happiness at Work, which I especially wanted to write, not just for people in finance, which is what the impression of the title, I think, sometimes conveys, but people really working on the front lines of suffering. And you wrote about your experience as an attorney and everything you kind of faced and the internal process of learning how to deal with it.
Yeah, I mean, it was a really interesting time. And I think actually going on retreat with you back then, this was probably 8 or 9 years ago, was one of the formative periods of my own practice to really beginning to see how the collective suffering of, you know, racial bias or gender bias, of all sorts of biases that exist and inequalities that exist in our society, were really playing out inside my own body and my own mind. And yeah, I was just really grateful that you were able to share some of that with the world in your book.
And it's quite a compelling story that you actually came, I think, to more or less specialize in really working with bias. And I think all the time about the relationship of mindfulness practice and implicit bias or unconscious bias, because of the very role of mindfulness in making the unconscious conscious.
Exactly. Exactly. And it's so interesting because that really has been my journey. So I think the work that I'm doing right now was actually a product of my own personal growth and how I was, you know, gifted with the practices of mindfulness and of various other Dharma practices to really apply to how I suffered personally with these notions of bias. And at the end of the day, these were just stories that I had in my mind, you know, that I had believed about myself, about other people. And this is what we call social conditioning, you know, more broadly speaking. So that's, and mindfulness, you know, and of course I've learned this from you and so many other teachers, is just the practice of noticing, becoming aware of whatever arises and oftentimes without judgment. But I also like to bring judgment into mindfulness because, you know, my mind especially is very judgmental. You know, I was trained as an academic, as a lawyer, so we are trained to be critical. And bringing mindfulness to that critical mind was basically the beginning of my own journey to understanding how bias played out in myself. And once I could see that, I could begin to see its implications more broadly, particularly in workplaces, and particularly in the way so many of our institutions and systems are designed. And then with everything that's happening right now in our country, like the pandemic and its, you know, egregiously disproportionate impact on Black communities, Native American communities, immigrant communities, and then, of course, the protests that are happening in light of the recent murders. So for me, a lot of this work really goes back to our hearts. You know, so it's beautiful that we're in the Metta Hour. It's really, I think, breaking bias overall for me is a heart practice.
Well, it's so powerful, I think, and interesting. Well, there's so much in what you just said, so I'll respond kind of part by part. It's very hard, I think, for people to hear something like mindfulness means being aware without judging and not think, well, that leaves you not caring in a way, you know, like, oh, so I feel this, I feel that, what's the difference? But there is a difference, especially when we bring those things into action. But the kind of corrosive edge of self-hatred, you know, like I shouldn't feel this and this is so terrible and this is all that I am and this is all I'll ever feel, doesn't seem to be onward leading, you know? You know, so sometimes I think it's a question of really understanding what we want. You know, do we want behavior change? We want to manifest differently in the world. We want to not feel so lonely, you know, and then see what can accomplish that. And so there's some fine place of being aware without freaking out about what we're seeing.
Right.
And then being able to resolve, you know what, I've been down that path that left me all alone. I don't want to do that anymore.
You know, it's really interesting what you said. I think for me, you know, as I was, so I was always inclined towards working in human rights and economic development. So basically, I grew up in New York City, to give everybody a little bit of context of who I am, and went to public schools in New York and went to college here. And originally, I went to college to become a doctor in the footsteps of my parents and my older sister. But I just love people and I love cultures. So quickly, I found myself more attracted to working abroad. And it was after college, I lived in South Korea for a year. And that's where I really became introduced to Buddhism and the Dharma, because I was teaching at a Buddhist school, at a middle school in rural South Korea. So there I was kind of acquainted with the Zen tradition. And while I was there, I started working in Myanmar. So I started a nonprofit called Opening Possibilities Asia. And we went there, and because I was a teacher, we led a lot of teacher training programs. So this is the year 2006, right? So at that time, Myanmar was probably the second most oppressive country in the world. It probably is one of the most oppressive countries still. And I was working in monastic schools. So basically, these were schools that were set up by Buddhist monks out of the generosity of their hearts because of just the brutality of the regime. And what they were doing was they were educating some of the poorest children in the country. And one of their tenets was anybody is welcome. It doesn't matter what their ethnic background is. It doesn't matter what their gender identity is. All kids were welcome. So this was a really unique situation. This was in Mandalay, a school called Pongdao, and where we had over 25 different ethnic groups represented, groups that were so used to a constant state of war because of the historic ways, you know, these divisions have been planted in that country. So I think for me, that's where my journey around metta began, and really thinking about where do these biases come from? Why do we hate? Where are these separations really stemming from? And that led me to wanting to do more international development work. So I went off to Cambridge after my time in Korea to study human development. And it was really there that my eyes were opened for the first time around this concept of bias. You know, because I grew up as an immigrant in New York and with brown skin and given what I look like, I've had a lot of experiences of feeling otherness, mm-hmm. but I had repressed those feelings. So I just didn't acknowledge that that ever happened. And when I was at Cambridge, the cool thing was, because it was such an academically stimulating environment, I was studying basically education for all, particularly in South Asia. And the way it works in India is that anybody of means sends their kids to private schools, and people that don't have money have to go to government schools, which is, I guess, comparable to our public schools in the US, but they're very, very under-resourced. And that's where the majority of Indian children and South Asian kids go to school. And a lot of them are of lower caste and basically kind of left behind. And it was interesting because as I was researching, where did these policies come from? I was literally going through the public records of the British Anthropological Surveys of India from the 1860s and 70s and in 1880s. And they were literally, you know, labeling entire groups of people through these racial classification systems and prescribing to them a whole host of, you know, moral, intellectual, aesthetic value. So they were just assigning these values to them. And that's where this whole idea of race really kind of was like, oh my gosh, this thing is just made up. It's a bunch of guys that literally sat around a table who probably felt really bad about themselves and projected onto other people, whole groups of people, you know, just all the negative attributes of our human existence. And those things have now become very concrete. So that's, and basically that's what led me to really wanting to investigate more and more deeply around how did these constructs come about? Why is it that, you know, we have all sorts of stereotypes associated with being Black or being Chinese or being Russian? Where did these ideas come from? At the end of the day, we're all human beings, right? But, and more importantly, similar things. Where are these ideas around being a woman and what a woman can or cannot do? Where do these ideas come from? So that kind of very intellectual curiosity led me into this work. Yet I was pursuing this work from my head. A lot of it was in my head. So again, I was doing this because I was wounded inside. You know, I'd been called a terrorist. I'd been called an other. I'd been called ugly. I'd been called, I mean, I can't remember how many times I've been told to go back to my country, you know, being in America.
New York. Right.
New York City. I'm like, okay. But it's funny because all those times when that happened to me, I took it personally. Mm-hmm. But the beautiful thing is, through the practices of the Dharma and of mindfulness, I realized that this wasn't personal. It just was. It's really fun. I was reading a book by Swami Vivekananda, who is, you know, one of the first people who brought mm-hmm. yoga and meditation to the West. And he wrote this book called Karma Yoga. And he had visited Chicago in the 1890s to speak at the first kind of international religious conference. I don't remember the exact name for it. And he wrote anecdotes in the book itself of how when he was just walking around the city of Chicago, you know, strangers would punch him in the face.
Oh my God.
Because he was a turban man. And he literally, if this is in the book Karma Yoga, anybody can, I mean, I had to purchase the book for my yoga teacher training, so I read it. And that was his experience with racism in America, because the height of xenophobia was so great at the time. But he doesn't talk about racism from a political sense. He talks about, he just didn't understand the hatred mm-hmm. in the eyes of this person who didn't even know him, but needed to be violent towards him to somehow make himself feel better. And I think once I read that, I began to see the bigger picture of what's happening around these ideas of bias in our society and how they really play out in the human heart.
Wow, that's beautiful. I mean, one of the things you just said, and I'd like to respond to a few of them, but mm-hmm. it reminded me of when you said, you know, people would be violent to make themselves feel better. I can remember when I co-wrote this book with Bob Thurman called Love Your Enemies. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't always the title of the book, but it ended up being the publisher's choice for the title. And people would often object, you know, like, why should I love my boss? They're an idiot, you know, or why should I love this person? They're oppressive or they're abusive. And Bob would say, well, of course you want to love them. That means you want them to be happy, because if they were only happy, they'd be so much less of a jerk.
Exactly. And, you know, like, we're basically, today I was watching the memorial for John Lewis. Mm-hmm. And basically that is what he stood for the entirety of his career, the entirety of his existence. He was able to have love for every single one of those officers that were beating him down, for all of the politicians that opposed everything he stood for on equality and justice. Mm-hmm. But that didn't mean he agreed with them. That didn't mean he didn't oppose them or speak out loud against them. Of course he did. He was kind of an activist and a protester. Yet he could still see their humanity. He could see the, you know, the, what do we call them, the three poisons, you know, that were clouding mm-hmm. over the true self that they are, beneath the greed, the hatred, the ignorance. And I think that's what our practices are really calling us to do and be at this time.
Now, I was watching a little bit of it too, and we'll watch more later. Which is the miracle of our time. I was thinking about that. This is totally off topic, but I was thinking about how we used to have a concept of missing things that were on TV, or, you know, if you weren't tuned into that channel at that time, it was gone forever. Right. Now it's like, oh, it doesn't matter. You know, I'll catch it later online. but anyway, I can't remember if it was President Clinton or somebody was speaking, and they were describing what was, maybe it was Barack Obama, they were describing what was in John Lewis's backpack when he went off to march across that bridge.
Toothbrush and, little things.
An orange and apple,
yeah.
A book about the racial history of the United States, and a book by Thomas Merton. Mm. And I thought, I never knew that he was carrying around a book by Thomas Merton.
Of course. Yeah. And it's so beautiful, right? Because this is kind of how we're all connected, the nature of interdependence. Because for him, you know, nonviolent resistance to oppression was a way of being. Mm-hmm. And he adopted that way of being a young person from the American South, you know, from Georgia, who's studying in Tennessee. Yet these ideas were adopted by our civil rights leaders after being inspired by the idea of satyagraha in India, right? Mm-hmm. Which is a lot of where Buddhist practices come from. And then those same people that were adopting satyagraha in India were being influenced by the Theosophical Society of America. Mm-hmm. Who were using those similar ideas. So it's just, you know, it's just so beautiful around the nature of interdependence, because no one really has ownership over the human heart, you know? Mm-hmm. And it just passes from one person to another, but it's really about us feeling empowered enough to follow that calling of remaining in our heart, remaining on the side of love. And, you know, love as a word, and I'm actually curious what you think about this, because it gets a really bad rap.
Yeah, it does.
It's like an anemic thing. It's like very soft, like you're a doormat. But I feel like to be able to love your enemies, to be able to humanize them, it's probably the most courageous thing and the boldest thing one can do.
Oh, I certainly agree. And I think it's a power. It's a superpower because I think it's aligned with how things actually are, interdependent, interconnected. We can't kind of just like vanquish people and imagine their lives have nothing to do with ours because it's not true. And it'd be easier if it was, maybe, as long as we won. But, you know, it's just not true. And the closer we get to the truth, it's just that's what empowers love is that it's true. It's like listening to the people in that church, listening to the example of John Lewis's life. And would we be all watching his funeral if he was full of hatred? Or I remember when I had the opportunity some years ago I spent the day with Miles Horton, who was the founder of the Highlander, then known as the Highlander Folk School. You know, which was an integrated school. A lot of civil rights workers went there for training, environmental rights workers a little later on. It was in Tennessee, and it was integrated. So that was like a big scandal and a big problem. And somehow I ended up spending a day with Miles Horton. And we talked about a variety of things. I talked about meditation, which he wasn't that interested in, frankly. You know, and I asked him, like, what do you do when you need a break, when you need just to get some perspective? He said, I look at the mountains. But then we started talking about loving kindness meditation. And he said, oh, Marty, meeting Martin Luther King Jr. He said, Marty used to say to me, you got to love everybody. And I used to laugh and say, no, I don't. I just have to love the people who deserve to be loved. And Marty would laugh and laugh and say, nope, you got to love everybody. And the few times I've actually told that story is often a response of, yeah, well, look what happened, you know, as though there were cause and effect, like he loved everybody, therefore he got assassinated. And that if he'd been hateful and bitter and vengeful, he would have been safe. You know, and it's such a funny equation in our minds that the love is going to bring us down. But you think about legacy, which I, you know, I'm older now, so one can think about that. And what are we remembered for? Look at the legacy, like the kind of lineage you just talked about, which was really like Gandhi to Dr. Howard Thurman to Martin Luther King Jr., you know, and to us, to whomever is feeling aligned with that mantle. So.
Yeah. And it's really, I mean, I think, this reminds me of two stories. You know, the first one, because, you know, I was working predominantly internationally and I wanted to work internationally, and I never thought I would become an expert on racial equity and breaking racial bias of all things. I'm very much a nerd who likes to sit in a corner and like just read and study and play. But it was a necessity. And I remember that this was 2009. I was working in New Orleans for summer as a summer associate in law school. And I was basically sitting in a sentencing hearing where this was, I guess, four or five years after Hurricane Katrina. So already there have been so many egregious crimes that have been committed against communities living there. But I saw this judge sentence, you know, teenagers, I would say, between the ages of 13 and 16, to 2, 3, 4 years at a time for incredibly petty offenses, things like breaking cell phones and trespass to property. And of course, all of these teenagers were Black and impoverished. And for me, of course, as egregious as it was, and actually I was sighing so hard that the officer of the peace of the court had to come and ask me to leave. So I was disrupting the peace of the court. And I think I felt a sense of moral disgust in my belly. And the disgust wasn't just about how egregious this was happening and how these young people's lives were just disposable, but I couldn't understand the cruelty. I had never seen that type of cruelty that this judge and this prosecutor and all these operatives in the court were just so conditioned to having. I was like, where is the love? Where is the compassion? Where is the mercy? You know, Bryan Stevenson talks about mercy, this idea. And that's where I really kind of started this quest. And for me, this quest really kind of came to a head, actually with you, Sharon, because I went on a retreat with you. It was a, I think it was a 7-day metta retreat, loving kindness retreat. And then it was like a tap on of like 3 days of forgiveness.
Let's try this out.
So like, I was like, okay, I'm going to do all of that. And I think we had started some forgiveness practices during the loving kindness retreat portion of it too already. And I remember that, you know, we were trying, you know, we went forgiveness from forgiving the self to, you know, loved ones and kind of expanding the circle to then moving towards people that have really harmed us. Mm-hmm. And then also thinking about how we may have harmed them. So for me, as someone who was really thinking about the harm of racial trauma and racial bias that was perpetrated against me and other communities that I care about, I started seeing those same seeds of hatred in myself. Mm. So I remembered every time in my life I had used a racial expletive to intentionally cause harm to another being, and particularly using the word white, you know, white person, you know, or something like that. And it wasn't that many times, but I remembered that I had done it to exactly 3 people. And once I was able to forgive myself for having that, I was free. I actually wrote them an email. It took me several months to do that, to have garnered the courage to do that. And I apologized. And for me, I didn't expect a response. It was not about that. It was like I was freeing myself from those seeds of hatred that were deeply planted in my heart, which were actually a product of self-hatred. Mm-hmm. So I think for me, like, that's where the healing really began. And I really believe that that's not something that only, I'm not a special person. I think this is all of our, you know, birthright. And this is what Dr. King was talking about when he's talking about radical love, when he's talking about loving everybody, because he was able to see that beyond the pain that they cause others, there's pain beneath that pain, you know? Mm-hmm.
I think we do learn that from looking at ourselves. You know, I certainly have. And sometimes, you know, we look at somebody who's causing harm and they don't seem to be suffering a lot. They seem to be just fine and pretty self-satisfied. But it really takes some reflection, I think, to understand that actually can't be. You know, they may be very disconnected from their pain, but it's there.
Exactly. Yeah, and that disconnection is so profound. So for the last several months, actually not months, several years, I've been working around that pain that's in my body, particularly around misogyny, around mm-hmm. gender bias and masculinity overall. And I think as someone who comes from like a very thinking background, I can intellectualize a lot of things, but I'd been working with a teacher, and for, I would say, 6 months, whenever I would like go into my thinking mind, she'd be like, stop, feel it, feel it, feel it. And Sharon, like, I was just numb. Mm. Like, I couldn't feel anything. And she shared with me that this is something that like 99% of men have trouble feeling. Mm. And I think this is part of, again, how we raise boys and men in our society. We are just numb to feeling, so we just become reactive versus responsive. So I think it becomes not only a, you know, responsibility to begin to heal that form of, you know, toxicity that's kind of stuck in my body, but then a moral obligation to bring it to other people, because so much harm is being caused because so many people are unable to feel. And at the end of the day, just feel.
Let's talk a little bit about that training that you do, Be More With Anu. So is that centered around being able to feel?
Yes, it depends on which training, right? So so one thing about me is that I am a very like linear thinker, but I like to break things up. At BMO, over the new, what we've done is that we've created a journey. So it's called the BMO journey. And we've broken up that journey into three stages: learn, develop, propel. The whole idea is we want to teach people, have them learn what they haven't learned about the nature of bias, racial bias, gender bias, other forms of biases. So that's more of a left brain exercise. But, you know, we can learn things. Like, a lot of us know the reality of racial disparities in our world, but we don't have the skills to address them, right? So that's where we need to develop the skills. So that's the second stage. And for me, it's really about building a movement, a beloved community. And the more people practice these tools together, we can propel performance. So we've broken that down into 10 skill sets and competencies that we train people in. So it's things like awareness, comprehension, optimism, curiosity, empathy and compassion, well-being, collective identity, and a few others. And then we have courses that basically train people in these skills. So we have two short courses that anyone can take for 60 minutes, really around breaking bias, and it's breaking unconscious bias more specifically. And that's available to anybody. This is what we've done in the last couple of months. In light of the protests, you know, we as a team basically took a step back and wanted to bring our work to as many people as possible. So we've made it quite affordable with the sliding scale thing. And then now I'm doing a four-week course for the first time called Breaking Racial Bias. I used to do this course in one day. We have added a lot more content. And we basically move from understanding the nature of systemic racism to how racial bias is formed in our minds, and then the different types of racial biases, you know, internalized, interpersonal, institutional, and then how to break it down. And the way we break it down is, you know, for me, through meditation and mindfulness-based practices. So we've created a framework of five tools called PRISM that are all rooted in meditation to help people become more aware of what's happening in their minds when they're interacting with people that are different from them. And then actively rewire their brains, you know, through tools like stereotype replacement and individuation, and then cultivating more heart practices like compassion and empathy and joy and perspective taking. So that's kind of what we do. So the four-week course is something that requires daily practice of a meditation tool, as well as homework, reflection exercises, journaling, and, you know, really showing up for both the lecture components and the community components of it.
So this is all happening online now, right?
This is happening online through Zoom. So we have like a learning session once a week for 4 weeks, and then a community discussion once a week. Mm-hmm. And it's actually a really beautiful group of people. We have over 30 people in the group. You know, doctors and lawyers and teachers and therapists. So it's very diverse, nonprofit executives. And the beautiful thing about this is that, you know, and this is why I'm really committed to this work that is rooted in compassion. So, you know, everything we do is science-backed, but it's also backed by compassion. Because if we don't have compassion, there's still shame and fear in the group. And when we have fear, nothing good is going to come out of it. We're not going to be able to change behavior. So when I think about civil rights movement leaders, when I think about all the people that opposed colonization, particularly, you know, in South Asia, where my family is from, they were fearless. They had opened their hearts, or had become embodied in their hearts in a way that they weren't afraid of anything. They weren't even afraid to die. Mm. And that is the beauty of this work. And that's, and I think what I see oftentimes in our movements right now is a lot of calling out and a lot of perpetuation of fear, you know, towards one another. And I don't think it's a right or a wrong or a good or a bad. It just is. You know, I don't want to judge it for what it is, because there are causes and conditions that are causing that too. But if there's a more skillful way of really calling more people in and to create collective healing, Mm-hmm. Why not do that?
Well, it's interesting because I think it's hard to sometimes remember what it is you really want. Like, we've had these discussions at IMS about should everybody who teaches here have to go to an anti-bias training of some kind? And that may be an evolution, but the point is what we want is a certain kind of behavior.
Right.
You know, and we have to keep an eye on that aspiration, you know, because that's the important thing. And maybe people will come to that more openness and more understanding through a specific anti-bias training. Maybe they will come to it another way. But that's what we really need is that spirit of inclusivity and recognizing everybody belongs here, you know, and it's not exclusive in any way. But I see it becomes kind of easy to focus on the method, you know, or the thing.
Sure.
And I want to ask you also, like, what do you think is the, like, how do you start those trainings? Like, what's the central conversation to begin with? Because I've been reflecting a lot. Like, I have a goddaughter who, she's an adult, but when she was very young, she was in a movie, mm-hmm. and she was born in China, adopted by her white parents, and grew up here in New York. And I don't know how old she was even in the movie, maybe 5. Mm-hmm. And she didn't have any lines. She barked at one point because there was a talent show. But she was on camera a lot, and she was the only Asian appearing child. And the movie had like – it was sort of like about a family reunion. There were lots and lots of kids and siblings' kids, and she was the only Asian child. And one of her mother's conditions for allowing her to be in the movie was that it never be mentioned that she was adopted. She said, I want people to look at this family, you know, mom, dad, which is already a construct, right. Mom, dad, you know, older siblings and her, and just think that's what families look like sometimes.
Right.
You know, it doesn't need to be explained, doesn't need to be mentioned. And it also reminded me of the first and one of the only times I watched Grey's Anatomy on TV by Shonda Rhimes. And I was so struck, like, the head of the hospital, the head of neurosurgery was black, and it was never talked about. It's just like, this is what a staff can look like sometimes.
Right.
You know, maybe this is even what it should look like. But lately I've been thinking, well, maybe that was skipping over a really important conversation, you know?
Right.
Like, what did he face in becoming the head of the hospital?
Exactly. Yes, I think it's so beautiful that you're asking this because I'm curious about this myself. I don't really have an answer, but so I think about it's both and, right? So I think for me, very much like what you shared, you know, my aspiration with my work and everything I do is really around creating a world where we can belong everywhere, you know, so that's my aspiration. And what keeps us from feeling that sense of belonging, you know, and this is where we have to become more intimately acquainted with how our mind sometimes makes people feel othered. And it may not be intentional, yet it can cause harm. So that's one thing. But on the other hand, what skills do we need that even if we feel othered, what can we do to stand up for ourselves? So I think it's both and now where, you know, like you said, there are lots and lots of hospital systems where, you know, the head of the departments are, you know, black women or, you know, Latino men or whatever it may be. Yet the stimuli that we receive from our social conditioning oftentimes doesn't look like that reality. And then we're not privy to the stories of those individuals. We're not privy to the pain and suffering that they're carrying. But beyond the pain and suffering, the loneliness, So like one of the things I wanted to share with you, I think it was something around what you shared earlier. And I remember, you know, as an undergrad, as a grad student, as a law student even, wanting to share how I've been made to feel smaller than, or maybe not made to feel because I'm giving away my power when I say that, but how I have felt lonely. And, you know, if someone called me XYZ or someone asked me again where I'm really from and wouldn't take Brooklyn for an answer or whatever it is, made me feel othered. And my emotions would not be validated by my own classmates and friends. Like I would be told that I'm overreacting and I'm being too emotional. And that is cognitive dissonance. But then that can create a lot of challenges, particularly for people from a non-dominant group. Like this is what, you know, I am beginning to unpack in myself when it comes to gender identity. You know, like women and female identified people oftentimes have to go through that where they're constantly questioning themselves. All they did was really express how they feel, but others aren't believing them. This happens around race and ethnicity and immigration. So I think for me, the aspiration is really that compassion-based container where we acknowledge that we're going to make mistakes, but we also acknowledge that when we make mistakes, you know, we will be, you know, kindly told what those mistakes are so we could grow together. You know, and we can take care of one another. We can be each other's, you know, brothers and sisters, keepers, in line with what, you know, John Lewis was about, you know, the legacy is about.
It's really beautiful. May it be so.
May it be so.
And I wonder, I would love to keep talking to you, but I know we need to stop. So I wonder if you could actually lead a meditation practice for a little bit.
Yeah, that'd be great. So wherever you are, just come to a comfortable seated position, making a chair, placing both your feet on the ground below you, really feeling rooted to the earth, to the floor, resting your hands on the lap or on the knees. And then you can either bring your eyes to a close, or place your gaze at a stationary point in front of you. And then for a few moments, just returning to your breath. Really observing this breath entering the body, this breath leaving the body. If there's some turbulence in the mind, notice what's happening. Perhaps there's thinking or planning or daydreaming. And see if you can become aware of that. Thinking. Planning. And see if you can bring your awareness back to your breath. This breath that's with us all the time. Since the very moment we were born. So really savoring this breath. Feeling as if with every in-breath, we're being healed to the out-breath. We're just letting go of anything that doesn't serve us. Really enjoying that process. Being one with the present moment. With this gift of life that comes through this breath. If the mind wanders off, that's okay. Notice what it's doing. And see if you can just bring your awareness back to that breath. What a gift it is that we can breathe. In a time with the pandemic, with violence against so many bodies of color, we're holding that aspiration that breath that we have is also there to honor all those bodies and those forms of life . May this breath really strengthen our resolve to respond skillfully with determination and compassion. Just taking a few more moments to enjoy this breath, savor this breath. Even expressing gratitude. For this breath. For enabling. Your own version of life experiences. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you so much. It was really beautiful speaking with you and sitting with you. We have to have lunch when we're both in New York next time.
Yes, I would love that.
May that be so too.
May that be so. Very soon, I hope.
I hope so too. And to learn more about Anu's work, you can visit www.bemorewithanu.com. That's bemorewithanu.com. A big thank you to all of you listening. This has been the Real Change series on the Metta Hour podcast. from the Be Here Now Network. May you be safe, may you be happy, may you be healthy, and may you live with ease.
Hey folks, thanks for listening. Real Change is available September 1st in hardcover, ebook, and audiobook formats. Learn more at realchangebook.com.